day and the week is off to a great start so far. Hi there and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. 10:06 is the time right now, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Well, it's time for Science Files this hour, our weekly look at some of the news from the world of science. St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker joins me this morning. I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, we'll go to the phones to hear what you've got to say this morning. Manic Monday is coming up next hour, and of course, as always, anything goes. And after the news at noon, the city and the union representing Halifax Transit's bus drivers and mechanics are at the bargaining table to negotiate a new contract. We'll get an update on the talks from union president Kenny Wilson. And we'll hear another Halifax history moment this afternoon when historian and author Blair Beat joins me. 10:07 right now, but this hour it's time for Science Files, brought to you by Meadow Ridge Estates, bungalow lifestyle living right here in Halifax. And with us in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you this fine?
I'm pretty good.
Rainy,
a little bit of rain out there.
Summery,
okay.
Almost.
Well, as we were just saying, like 8 degrees last week. I was down in Liverpool at White Point, and we even had one day when it was up around 11 degrees. That was kind of crazy, to be honest.
It's crazy indeed.
And this has really got to be like the warmest February we've ever had. I'm convinced to that. Other than us, like, now I've jinxed it and we'll have like 10 days of like minus.
We know where you live. We'll come and get you.
2 days left. No, like, even I can't mess that up. So anyway.
Hopefully. And again, this has been one weird kind of winter so far. Not that I'm complaining or anything like this. Climate change is just one of those little freaky things that happens from time to time.
No, this does seem to be climate change. I mean, it is. So you should have Cindy in talking about this one.
Yeah.
But so it does seem to be the case that the weather patterns around the eastern seaboard have really changed. That now we have systems that used to come in and sort of like stay around over Nova Scotia, give you the same kind of weather for a week or so. Those are actually changing towards one system coming in, another one coming up from the south, pushing it out of the way, and then this kind of oscillation a little bit. And so this is really changing our weather patterns over the winter, and it's kind of amazing to see it in living memory, to be honest.
Because in much of the rest of the country, I mean, they're having almost regular winters, are they not?
Yep, definitely. Yeah. So I was speaking to people that I work with in Ottawa as well, and they were saying that, yeah, they've had lots of their usual freezing rain. So,
out in the prairies, it's, you know, in the minus 20s and lots of snow. And you know, they can have it. And we'll keep
As my wife discovered, she went back to see her parents. She said, it's cold in Edmonton. And I'm like, you know it's cold in Edmonton. You grew up there.
Yeah, indeed. Well, let's take a couple of phone calls, get them out of the way here this morning.
Sure.
Paul has got an interesting question for us here this morning. Hi, Paul.
Morning, buddy. How are you?
I'm all right. What's your question here?
Okay, I've been waiting to get Dr. Rob on the air to ask him this.
Oh, that sounds bad.
Oh, he knows a little bit about everything. That's the reason.
Yeah.
Dr. Rob, my question is this. They say there's no stupid question unless you know the answer. And my question is, I live four stories up. It's a relatively new building. And when the wind's blowing outside, quite strong, the water in my toilets sways back and forth. Do you have an explanation for that?
I think I do. And so that's an issue with plumbing. And in any water system associated with a toilet, you'll actually have a venting pipe which will go up through the ceiling and outside. And so that is directly attached to the atmosphere. And so because of that, any changes in pressure that are happening outside will be reflected in sort of movements in the water in your system, right? So you will see that. And so I think, I'm pretty sure that's what it is, in fact. So it's just because of the vent that we have on toilets, and you'll see that come down and sort of like just...
Well, thank you. I knew you'd know that.
Plumber can probably jump in and give you the exact answer on that, but I think that's what it is.
I'm glad to got the answer you're looking for, Paul.
The best.
All right, but take care. Let's hear what Wayne's question is this morning. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Dr. Thacker. My question is relates to my lack of understanding when you're talking about space-time.
Okay.
And the warping of space. If I was standing in front of you, there would be space between us. How do you warp that?
Yeah, so this is one of these things where you go, you know, your common sense isn't really going to help you here. And that's one of the challenging things with physics. And so the fact of the matter is, if when we talk about the warping of space-time and we said, well, is the space between us warped? I mean, if we're in a very, very strong gravitational field, that would be true. And so if, for example, I just drop something in a very strong gravitational field, we'll both see it fall. And that is actually the curvature of space-time right there. And it's kind of a really difficult thing to explain in common sense terms, because we can't really see this warping or feel this warping in any sense or form that we understand to be easy to understand. But it does, in fact, change how things move through space and time. And the other thing is, when you talk about space-time, right, you're talking about a four-dimensional system. And so I'm just going to come out and say it. I can't imagine what things look like in 4D, right? I struggle with 3D sometimes. So
and so
it's difficult to describe that in common sense terms. And sometimes you just kind of have to go with what the mathematics tells you. Now, I'm sure there are very, very nice long arguments and discussions that you can find on the internet about this. But I tend to argue that it's about how things want to move. And things really want to try and move, in some sense, in a straight line as possible. But when space-time is curved, those straight lines are no longer straight. They're bent. Right?
Which is the result of gravity.
Exactly. So those things that we consider to be, to the particle as a straight line, are in fact curved and bent, and that is the curvature of space-time right there.
Well, if you struggle with some of that,
yep,
and you mentioned a dimension, and they talk sometimes about many dimensions and how Einstein, if he could have looked at this from the fifth dimension, may have been able to come up with this theory of everything. I struggle with trying to imagine what the sixth and seventh dimensions would be like if I was living in them.
I'm right there with you.
Okay.
So that is something called Kaluza-Klein theory. And so as you extend the number of dimensions that you have in the physical theory that represents general relativity, you can get all sorts of different types of additional physics that come out of that. You can actually get basically something that looks like the electromagnetic force, if I've got it right. And so there was a sort of feeling very early on in the 1930s and 40s that you would be able to create a theory of everything that describes all of these additional interactions by adding more and more dimensions. That's turned out not to be true, but what has replaced it is string theory and things like that, which all themselves are best formulated in, I think it's something like 11 dimensions, or though it depends upon the type of the theory. And then you have to do something with all of these extra dimensions. You have to wrap them up somehow so that we can't interact with them. But even then, they may still sort of have some small impact on our three and plus one dimensions. So it's kind of crazy, but kind of fun as well.
Hmm. Be quite a homework assignment for one of your students, for sure.
I'm absolutely not setting this as a homework assignment because I don't understand it well enough either.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. And I read somewhere that, I mean, there's some speculation. There's a theory that other dimensions, it's like a parallel universe kind of thing to it. So that maybe in some other dimension right now,
yeah,
there's a talk show with Rob Thacker hosting and Rick Howe the guest.
Let's break that down, because you put two things together. So the idea that there could be quote-unquote parallel universes is kind of related to quantum theory and something called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And so that sounds absolutely freaky the first time you hear it. The weird thing about quantum mechanics is, as far as we can tell, when someone's conscious, like you and I, makes a measurement of an atomic system, very, very small, doesn't behave in the common sense ways, we actually make it take on a particular state. And so this is something that's perplexed physicists for literally over 100 years now. And we still don't really understand fully what's going on in that process, or we know what happens in the experiment, right? So that's the where we'll always fall back on the experiment to say we know what's going on. But the theory of what happens is very, very difficult. And so the many worlds interpretation is, every time you make a measurement on these systems, you are in fact splitting the universe into all of the different possibilities that could have happened, right? And you just happen to go down one of those particular ones, and there are all of these infinite copies of you off in all of these other universes.
Yeah.
And it sounds kind of crazy, but mathematically,
it's possible.
It's possible, right? So this is a theory that's been around. And I know a lot of very, very smart physicists who really do subscribe to this many worlds interpretation. But for all intents and practical purposes, it doesn't really matter, because we live in one world and we experience one world, right? There's no way that we know of communicating between these parallel worlds. And so then the whole idea of extra dimensions That is a different set of different kettle of fish, a different kettle of dimensions, in as much that there may be small wrapped up other dimensions that somehow impact our own through very, very small differences. And so people are trying to do very, very high precision experiments to measure, for example, how things fall in gravitational fields, because gravity is one of the places where you would expect to see these differences. So far, haven't seen anything. So, but it's something that's worth thinking about and worth sort of like trying to come up with experiments to see if we can measure anything.
So this is just not science fiction. This is a possibility.
No, it's not. So certainly the many worlds interpretation is completely legitimate. And I mean, this is something that you learn about if you take quantum physics at university. And extra dimensions, it's a legitimate subject of study. It's not crazy, but it's not clear that there's any experimental evidence for them whatsoever at the moment.
10:17 our time with Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. This is Science Files. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more right after this quick break. Coming up now to 10:20. On a Monday morning, Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker, our guest here this morning. And Dr. Crazy Cat Lady writes, or he tweets rather, to say Science Files is one of the greatest segments of this show. And Dr. Rob Thacker is such a wonderful personality and accessible teacher. I can't imagine, she writes, how engaging his classes are at SMU. Sounds like you got a fan out there.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted that someone's getting that much out of the show. That's great.
And Jill just retweeted it, so you've got two fans out there. Let's talk about curling. And it turns out, as you write here in this note you sent me, that the physics of curling is really, really complicated. And you write, when 1980s TV star Mr. T revealed his love of curling. And if people have seen the A-Team, know who Mr. T is.
Well, no, I can be Mr. T as well.
You can?
Thacker.
Oh, that's right.
I say, take it from me, Dr. T.
Anyway, yeah. What'd he say? Okay, fool. Something like that.
Pity the fool.
Pity the fool, yeah. Anyway, he revealed that he loves curling on Twitter this week, and he told his followers it's not as easy as it looks. And he's right. It's not.
Seriously.
But you say a couple of Canadian scientists have discovered, I think they've discovered, why it is that the rocks will curl so well on these pebbled ice sheets.
So I'm just going to come out and say it. I'm not convinced they've got the right answer, though. So this is something that is perplexed physicists for a number of years, because when you look at how the rocks are curling, there's a couple of things that can happen when things spin. Like, there's changes in air pressure. So if you have a table tennis ball and you sort of chop it and spin same thing with a golf ball as well, that the changes in the net air pressure associated with all of the spin will actually create a lateral force that moves it through the air. But a curling rock is just not moving fast enough for that, right? So it's not spinning fast enough to have anything. So physicists have been trying to think, what's going on here? And so the latest idea is called a stick and pivot idea. And so basically what's happening is, on one of the sides that's moving slightly faster than the other side, slightly slower, it's actually sticking a little bit more.
To the ice,
yeah. And so you've got a heavy rock, obviously, and so there is pressure that's going down that's probably just sort of like melting and maybe making it stick and so on just a little bit. And so the idea is, it's called the stick and pivot, so literally one side of it is sticking ever so slightly, just a tiny amount, and that's just dragging the rock around. And so they've come up with a formula for this. This is two physicists, I should say, from the West Coast, and they think they can explain what's going on. But there are other theories, of course. There's another theory that what's actually happening is the interaction of the weight of the rock on the ice.
And this is pebbled ice we're talking about.
Pebbled ice, exactly, is actually creating a particular channel for the rock to move along. And so I'm not sure I fully believe that either, but that's the alternative theory. So this is something that is actually, it's been really fun to see that all of this science talked about as part of the Olympics. That's kind of cool, crossover. So, but anyway, the stick and pivot theory seems to be the one that people are going with at the moment.
I remember we had our good pal Richard Thoreski in one time. He was talking about the science of the curveball.
Yeah.
Which sounds sort of...
So the curveball is when you're putting enough spin that you change the net pressure on one side of the ball versus the others, and you get this drift across.
Yeah.
With a knuckleball, The interesting thing is a knuckleball is a bit different because then you're trying to throw the ball with the laces completely static and not moving.
Yeah, yeah.
And that actually creates a sort of like turbulent flow over the ball, which is really unpredictable and makes it wobble through the air.
Okay.
Right. And so if you've seen any pitchers throwing up close, actually seeing knuckleballs coming at you at like 50, 60 miles an hour is really quite impressive to see them wobble in the air.
Yeah. But yeah. The curling rock curl is...
It's not spinning fast enough for that kind of physics to come into play.
But the pebbled ice is important in the aspect
definitely.
Of health.
The pebbled ice may... I wouldn't be surprised if this really does boil down to the particular form of pebbling of the ice. But, you know, I'm sure there are people who work on creating the ice that we would have a better understanding of different types of ice and how the rocks curl under different circumstances.
Indeed. Let's go to back to the phones. Alexander, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Dr. Thacker. How
good
are you?
Good morning. Great, thank you.
I had a quick question, and it might be in the silly question category, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
No one's been there so far.
Not even me.
ever since I've been growing up, I've always heard of the universe has been expanding, and now I just read a recent article, it's expanding even faster than not. What does it expand into? Is there something else? Like, when I think of something expanding, I think of a balloon expanding with something around it.
I know exactly why this bugs people, and I completely understand. It's because when we grow up, everything that we understand, one thing is inside of another thing, right?
Exactly.
So when our bedrooms are in our house is on the road is in the city is in the country is on the planet's in the solar system, and so on. And so the answer that I have is that that has to come to a stop somewhere. And if it doesn't come to a stop somewhere, then wherever it goes on to, that's going to be the universe as well, right? So sooner or later...
I'm trying to think what you just said here.
Right?
All right.
So if you say there's something outside the universe, you could literally say, well, that's the universe. Right?
Okay.
So what we're saying with the particular shape of the universe is that if you want to think of what's actually happening to it, you actually have to think of it in some cases as being like the surface of a balloon. Sorry, I'm going back down to two dimensions. And so the thing is actually blowing up. And you could say, well, could I go off in one direction and come back to the same point? Well, you know, potentially, but we really don't know about what the shape of the universe is on enormous scales. We can only know about the stuff we can see.
Mm.
Okay. And so the stuff that we can see is what's called the observable universe. Right. And
okay.
So we say that the point at which there's nothing bigger, that's when you've got to the universe. Right. Because if you say, well, maybe the universe is embedded in something bigger, well, then I'm going to say, well, that's the universe.
Yeah. Okay. But what's on the other side of the universe?
Well, I can't actually answer that, right?
Can anybody?
No one can say. We can only say, so this is the thing, right? I mean, I'm going to be a really good scientist and I'm going to admit what the limits of our knowledge are. And the limits of our knowledge are what we can see. And so we can only see out so far because of the finite age of the universe. So what's out beyond the very most distant bits we can see, which is essentially the cosmic microwave background, right? We don't know. That's like this relic radiation from the Big Bang. We don't know. We could possibly use gravitational waves to get a little bit more signal, but there's still stuff out there that we really cannot see. And if the universe is infinite, we'll never be able to see it all.
But you're saying that the expansion, will it sometimes stop? That there be Did you just say that?
Okay, so in terms of the long-term future of what's going to happen with the expansion, at the moment, what we think is that actually we're going to expand faster and faster and faster. And so that makes you think, well, isn't the universe going to get more and more empty? And the answer to that is yes, that's what looks like is going to happen. But all of that said, there is the possibility that there could be other different, I'm going to call them energy fields for want of a better term, that could exist and could actually even be related to the very earliest moments of the universe as well, that could actually change what happens to the universe's overall evolution. But the honest fact of the matter is if we take the simplest interpretation of Einstein's equations and extrapolate into the future, it looks very much like the universe is going to get colder and emptier.
Hmm. Alexander, does that answer your question?
Sort of. I'm sure at the end of it, there's either going to be a Starbucks or a Tim Hortons. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. 1028 is our
time. With a black hole for their garbage can.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Dr. Rob Thacker, my guest at Science Files. Kevin, stay there. We'll get to you right after a news update. But we do have to take a quick break. Science Files with Dr. Rob. We'll be back after the news, and a news update is coming up next. 10:33 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker with me this hour. It's Science Files, and if you've got a question for us this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Just before we go to Kevin on the line, the Weather Network has issued its spring weather forecast, and it goes on to say that while Atlantic Canada has had a relatively mild winter, winter will still have several parting shots for the region, including a few nor'easters. For some places, the biggest snowfall of the year is still yet to come. I'm sure I like this forecast so far, Dr. Rob.
Yeah, no, that would be... So one of the things is, as the weather starts to warm up, you get a little bit more moisture in the air, so you can get those really big dumps of snow.
Back and forth temperatures, it says, swings should come close to offsetting, but with more potential for the warmth to outweigh the periods of colder weather. Well, that's good news. And an active storm track will tap into subtropical moisture at times and bring above normal precipitation to most of the region through the spring season.
Not out of it yet.
Not out of it yet. No, indeed. All right, let's go to the phones. And Kevin's got a question for us this morning. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Rick. Hello, Dr. Rob.
Hi, Kevin.
I love your show, Dr. Rob, and I love your show too, Rick.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before I ask my question, I remember as kids back in the middle, late 60s in Newfoundland, we'd get an iceberg that would ground. And as kids, we'd go out in the boats, of course, stupid kids,
yep.
And we'd try and get some ice off of the berg. And hitting that iceberg would be like taking an axe and hitting a piece of plate steel. Now, it's a sort of double question. Dr. Rob, what would be the ratio of density between glacial ice and, say, man-made ice? And the second part of my question would be, if you took a cubic foot of glacial ice and a cubic foot of, say, man-made ice, and you melted them, would you get the same amount of water? I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
I appreciate the call. Thank you. Interesting question.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. So glacial ice is basically ice that's formed from precipitation in mountains, and so that will be made from fresh water. Sea ice, that's different, obviously, and that will tend to have a large amount of salt water in it, so it will form in very, very cold water. And so I would say that if you form glacial ice from just regular fresh water and then you created your own basically ice from fresh water as well, I'm not necessarily sure there should be any real difference in the density of those at all.
Ice is ice, isn't it?
Well, presumably, salt water and fresh water do have different densities. So presumably if you made ice from regular fresh water versus salt water ice, then those would have different densities as well. I suppose it's also true that you can have different types of inclusions, like the same way you have inclusions, sort of holes within diamonds, you can have inclusions within ice as well. So I suppose those could actually affect the density of ice as well. I would be really curious to know if glaciologists have actually measured differences in densities. I'm sure that they probably are, depending upon the rate of inclusions in a given set of ice. And presumably, if you put ice under pressure as well, you can have a very, very small impact on its overall density as well, right? But very, very small. We're talking fractions of a percent, I would expect, because largely it's incompressible.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. So my gut reaction is if you just cut a cubic meter of ice off the top of a glacier, compared it to a cubic meter of ice that you'd frozen yourselves, there shouldn't really be very much difference between the two at all. That's my gut feeling. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I can't really see why there should be a really, really big difference.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Bonita has a question for us this morning. Hi, Bonita.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. My question is, why did the Big Bang theory happen?
Why did the Big Bang happen?
Okay. No one knows.
What changed?
No one knows. I mean, that's just science being completely upfront. No one really knows. And we can't really say what was happening before the Big Bang, because in some interpretations of it, that's when time literally came into existence, right? We tend to think of time as this thing that's always there. But in fact, you can think of time as being something like, where is the North Pole, right? You can always say, I can go north, I can go further north. But when you get to the North Pole and you say, okay, I want to go north, there's nowhere to go from that. And so time could actually be a similar kind of thing, that from the very beginning, there's nothing really happening before that.
Hmm.
And okay, can I ask you something sort of related?
Go ahead.
You say that the universe is expanding. Why don't the planets, like, expand? Why do they stay round and spin?
That's a great question. Right. So the fact of the matter is things expand on absolutely enormous scales. And so on very much smaller scales, like the scale of our solar system and so on, then we're actually kind of taking ourselves away from that expansion on very, very big scales. So you can think of it if you want to. It's not perfectly accurate, but if you want to, you can think of things like gravity. You can think of things like electromagnetism. All of the other forces of nature are actually overriding that expansion on very, very small scales.
Okay.
Thank you, Benita.
Thanks.
All right. No problem.
Bye-bye. Colin with an interesting question. Here he says, I was always to understand that the universe was curve-shaped and is expanding. And as mentioned, the rate of expansion is speeding up. At some point in the very, very distant future, eventually the universe flattens and then collapses into a supermassive black hole. And all the matter of the universe collapsing so fast into the black hole condenses so quickly that it explodes into another Big Bang on the other side, creating a new universe. Is that a legit theory I've heard before, or am I making this up?
No, that is the cyclical theory for the universe. And so there are a few sort of it's like technical things, right? So, how can I explain this? So the idea of basically the universe collapsing into it, becoming a black hole, is not actually correct, because there's very mathematical differences between the beginning of the universe versus what happens in a black hole. And those two things are actually a bit different. But this idea that the universe can basically expand, reach a point and then collapse back down again, that's legitimate, right? There are geometries in Einstein's theory of relativity that could actually be a good representation of that. So we wondered this for a very long time, and we thought that basically because the simplest kind of equations that come out of Einstein's theory do predict a universe that just basically expands and expands, but slower and slower and slower over time. And you get really beautiful, really simple equations from that. But the evidence is strongly that actually, no, that's not what's happening. The universe is going from looking like that to actually going and accelerating away faster. It looked like it slowed down, but now it's accelerating and going away faster. So what could possibly happen in the very, very far future? We don't know. The idea of the cyclical universe of things expanding and then coming back down, we don't think that can happen in a way that we used to say 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, we thought there could be sort of like, I don't know, like a 30 billion lifetime for the universe, it would come back down. We're pretty convinced that's not going to happen now, although obviously it's billions of years in the future, right? So we are playing the games of predictions. But we really do think what's going to happen is basically the universe will just keep on expanding and getting faster and faster and faster. So this idea of collapsing back down again doesn't look very likely with all of the evidence we have right now.
Now, I consider myself to be a fairly intelligent guy, but I tell you what, I'm having a real hard time trying to comprehend the concept of the Big Bang. I mean, what was there that led to the Big Bang? What was there before, and what caused the Big Bang to get where we're at today?
So that's completely legitimate. And to be completely frank, right, there's no common sense thing that we can fall back on to describe this, because we live in a universe with matter. We have things happening all around us all of the time. So for us, the idea of nothing is really alien. And in fact, I think it's Einstein who said nature abhors a vacuum, right? Because there's always things going on. And so the honest answer is, the theories that we have for the beginning of the universe are very much coated in a, well, maybe kind of situation. And one of the things that many of us like is the idea that actually the universe is going through this sequence of Big Bangs, where basically one particularly small part of the universe suddenly explodes off into its own different universe and actually just becomes an entirely separate evolutionary event along this chain of what's called eternal inflation. And so that's something that a lot of people quite like. It's quite beautiful, but there's very, very difficult to know how we'll get evidence for that. It's particularly difficult because all of the information that we would like to know about that earlier universe is gone, because all of the rapid expansion that happened during the big, or just after the Big Bang, that's gone. So all of this is extremely difficult for people to figure out. And I would say, when you read these books by people like Brian Greene and so on, just remember that what they're saying is these are the best theories that we have. No one is saying this is absolutely what happened. It's going to be probably a long time before we really have that kind of information. Although I would say we now know a lot more about the very earliest moments of the universe than we did perhaps 20 years ago. We know lots of things about what was happening with inflation, sudden rapid expansion that then slowed down again, and things like that. And so we are making progress. But right now, talking about those very, very earliest moments, we really don't have the theory that we need to do that. That's something called quantum gravity, and Einstein couldn't do it. People are still trying to figure that one out.
Patrick just emailed to say, with all of the mass centralized so closely after the Big Bang, why did it not collapse into a black hole immediately after the Big Bang?
That is a most excellent question. That is what's called a fine-tuning question, and a very, very good one. So if it's very slightly overdense, then yes, it would have collapsed back down again. What is amazing to us is the fact that the universe survived from those very earliest moments when it would be very unstable and actually want to collapse down, like he was saying. And so this is something that's vexed physicists for a long time. How can the universe be set up in such a perfect way that it doesn't actually collapse down? And so the theory of inflation actually gets around this by creating an energy field that suddenly drives very, very, very rapid expansion. And so any large differences that you have from being this perfect density go away as you actually get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so that's why the theory of inflation goes back to Alan Guth, and people before Alan Guth actually have suggested this, that this would be one way to get around that particular fine-tuning problem. But it is a very, very, very serious question that people take very seriously.
10:45, and Will with a tweet question wondering if our science guy, Dr. Rob, plans to run for city council. All kinds of strange questions on the segment.
I'd actually have to get to be a naturalized Canadian to do that.
Ooh, there you go.
Yeah.
And is that in the works?
I'm just a permanent resident. I do have to do that. Yes, I do.
Good. 10:45, Dr. Rob, my guest here at Science Files Time. And if you've got a question for him, give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with more right after this.
Here's Rick.
Here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker, my guest on Science Files. And let's talk about the launch of, Elon Musk's latest. He launched a rocket, I guess, that had on board one of his cars, a Tesla, with a dummy inside it.
Yep.
Dressed up as an astronaut, and this was released out into orbit somewhere, mm-hmm. and it's just kind of drifting out in space right now. What was the point of that? And tell me about this.
Well, the point of that is a beautiful publicity stunt. There's got a lot of people who wouldn't be interested in space thinking, "Wow, a car in space? How crazy is that?" And so, he's copped a bit of flack for it, and in some ways, perhaps deservedly so, because people would say, "Look, this is such a big deal. Why are you sort of making a show of it?" But to be frank, I kind of am sympathetic to him on this. That I think he's done a huge publicity stunt, and let's be clear, that launching Falcon Heavy and getting those boosters to come back down, that is a big deal for SpaceX, especially for their business model, right? One of the things that's not been made entirely clear is that they can reduce their cost to orbit significantly by using the Falcon Heavy rocket. And so this is a big part of their basically future business plan to reduce the cost to orbit. And so kudos to them for making it work. The whole car in space thing, you know, I know a lot of people who don't like it. I don't know. I think he's kind of acting like the kids who put the little Lego person on the balloon and took a picture. Yeah. And so I'm really, in a way, kind of sympathetic to that. He's also caught a lot of flack because if you look at the workforces for SpaceX and Tesla as well, they have a very, very small number of women, like the smallest of some of the major companies in Silicon Valley, right? Compared to Apple, Apple's like 30-odd% or something like that, whereas I think SpaceX is 15%. The counter people are saying, well, they seem to be able to put things in orbit. And so you're wondering, yeah, but are they still interviewing fairly? Are their biases coming in and so on? But I think that's a bit of a side story in relation to what they've achieved in terms of their engineering feats. But yeah, so there are all sorts of issues there that are coming up. But no, I think this is a good thing. I really do. It's kind of interesting. And, you know, there's already been an astrophysics paper published about what the long-term future of this car is.
Well, I'm reading here that it could be crashing into Earth or Venus.
Yes, there's a few percent chance that over the next 30 million years, it may hit the Earth or it may hit Venus.
30 million years?
Yeah.
This thing's going to float it there for that long?
Yeah, well, potentially.
That would be an antique car. But.
Well, so that's the thing that gets me, right? So with all of these things that we're doing right now, we sort of think, oh, yeah, they're gone and whatever. But who knows, in a few thousand years, when you have presumably space vehicles that are good enough to go around in the inner solar system and pick things up, what's going to happen to his car? What's going to happen to the old Apollo landing sites? Are they going to declare heritage sites, whatever? So NASA has thought about this.
Okay.
And they said, well, you know, we should declare some of these as specifically heritage sites so people can't go and loot them for memorabilia. Right,
like so, the flag at maybe waving on the moon kind of thing.
All sorts of like the landing module as well. So this is something that's actually worth thinking about right now. So the Tesla is going to be a, I don't know, it's a bit of space history right now.
It certainly is. Anyway, SpaceX launched the first ever Falcon Heavy on the 6th of this month. The 230-foot tall rocket's three boosters helped to push that Tesla Roadster into space. What's the purpose of this huge rocket ship then? This is more of
It's just getting more into orbit. That's all it's about, right? So the more mass you want to put in orbit, the heavier the thing you want to put into orbit, then the bigger the rocket you have to use. And so that's all there is to it. And so the next generation after Falcon Heavy is the BFR, which he says stands for Big Falcon Rocket. The word out of SpaceX is that's not what it actually stands for. But anyway, so
he's got a sense
so
of
they're now saying that they are working full on the design of the BFR. And if that's true, that's going to be really interesting to see how soon they actually do test flights. He was saying the test flights they'll do will literally be testing it going up and landing. And they have a new test site where they can do this in Brownsville in Texas. And so I believe he was saying that they hope to be able to do the first tests of the BFR engines within a couple of years. And if that's true, that's a lot faster than certainly I had anticipated. So we'll see whether they deliver. Obviously, Falcon Heavy was essentially 4 years behind time schedule. But, you know, even if they have a flying BFR by 2025, 2026, I think that would still be pretty impressive.
Yeah, no question. 10:53 is the time here right now. Let's talk about the moon's water. And a new analysis of data from two lunar missions finds evidence that the moon's water is widely distributed across the surface and is not confined to a particular region or type of terrain. It's everywhere on the moon?
Yeah, apparently so. So one of the things with the water on the moon is we should say, now there may be small pockets of real ice in the craters around the north and south pole of the moon. So those are permanently in shade. There could possibly be very small amounts there. But most of the water, we suspect, is either in a form in minerals, so water-bearing minerals, or it's actually sort of like locked into glass and things like that. So, but in this particular case, with the water-bearing minerals, what people thought was, well, you know, you've got to have deposits of mica, apatite, and things like that around the surface, so they probably won't be evenly distributed. But they can actually go around and they can look for the very specific radiation associated with water and oxygen and hydrogen. And so they've found significant evidence that actually it's distributed pretty much everywhere, which would be really great, because then if you needed to actually get water out of these minerals, then you could pretty much land anywhere and you know you have some. Now, we're talking tiny, tiny amounts in a few kilograms of rock. I mean, really, it's not a lot of rock. There's going to have to be very careful thought to how we process these minerals to get this water out and so on in an effective way. But nonetheless, having water evidence actually all over the surface of the moon is a new step forward, and it's kind of interesting.
I wonder if they were aware of that when they actually had manned landings on the moon, or perhaps they just weren't aware that the water existed at that time.
No, they weren't. I mean, it was presumed when there were landings on the moon that essentially the moon's surface was sterile, there was no water, it was completely dry and so on. I mean, to a certain extent, you can argue that it is dry in as much that the water is sort of like wrapped up in these water-bearing minerals, but nonetheless, there is water there. So they've actually gone back and reanalyzed a number of the moon rocks and said, yeah, there you go. There is a very small amount of water wrapped up in these rocks.
There's before we go, a new story out to talking about debris in space and how big a concern that is.
Yeah.
And even a 1 centimeter piece says here the kinetic energy of an exploding grenade. And from what I understand about what's, you know, orbiting this planet, yeah, there's a lot of debris out there.
Yeah, well, so there is more debris all the time, and it is an issue. And so the reason why there's so much energy in these things is because to be in orbit, you have to travel incredibly fast. And so you're literally going several times the speed of a rifle. So it's not the energy of a rifle bullet, it's the energy of a grenade in just a small 1 centimeter piece of these things. So the International Space Station actually has armor on it, right?
To armor, try, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's got Kevlar armor. They don't call it armor. They call it shielding, but yeah, it's really armor, yeah, right? And so it has all of these to try and capture things that are coming and hitting the space station. Micrometeorites hit the space station on a fairly regular basis. And so this is something we have to think about. And so if we have collisions in orbit, that's a real, real problem because of the debris field. And anyone who's seen Gravity knows what I'm talking about, right? The movie Gravity.
Yeah.
Right. So, yes, it's a concern. And in fact, one of the new satellite constellations, so thousands of satellites all working together to provide satellite internet, which we should talk about because I think that's really interesting from a Nova Scotian perspective, is that some people are trying to get a denial of the license for this because of the threat associated with collisions in orbit, creating debris fields, and then actually creating a situation where you can't put satellites up at certain heights around the Earth. And so this is a very legitimate concern, something that people are taking very seriously. The counter is that what they're looking to do with the next generation of satellite internet is to actually put them in very, very low orbits, like a couple of hundred miles up, that will actually decay back down fairly quickly. And they're fairly small satellites. At most, I think people are talking about 400 kilograms, probably less than that. And so then they'll actually decay down and they'll be replaced constantly, launching every sort of like 2 or 3 years to replace them.
Oh, okay. And perhaps that from Council Nova Scotia, perhaps.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows?
But I'm reading here, the European Space Agency estimates there are roughly 166 million man-made objects in space, ranging in size from 1 millimeter to the size of a refrigerator.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So once you get down to the really, really small things, about a millimeter, you'll have way, 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 way more of those, and you will have things that are significantly bigger than, say, a spanner.
Yeah.
Although we do know there's a spanner going around because there was one lost from the International Space Station. So.
Very interesting hours, they always are, when you drop by, Dr. Rob.
Always a lot of fun. And as I like to say, anyone who starts with "this might be a stupid question," it almost certainly isn't.
Indeed. Well said. Thank you, Dr. Rob. And thanks. Science Files is brought to you by Meadow Lake Estates, bungalow living, lifestyle living right here in Halifax. 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off. Our first open hour of the week comes up after the news. We call it Manic Monday. And, of course, as always, anything goes in our lines. Await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back to take your calls after the news, and that is coming up next.